Well, I'm delighted to share a few words as a reading from Urshad Manji's book titled Allah, Liberty and Love, The Courage to Reconcile Faith and Freedom. If you want to understand the inner struggle going on in the Middle East as it modernizes, this book is a great resource, along with her first book written after September 11th, 2001 attacks, titled The Trouble with Islam Today. Winner of Oprah Winfrey's first Chutzpah Award for boldness, Manji teaches moral courage at New York University's Graduate School of Public Service. The New York Times called her Osama bin Laden's worst nightmare. I mentioned her today because she is one of the outstanding champions of individual freedom in the Islamic world. She advocates for an unfamiliar way, at least in the West, of practicing her faith called ijtihad. Ijtihad. Ijtihad is Islam's native tradition of dissenting, reasoning, and reinterpreting. She points out in her book that it comes from the same root as jihad, to struggle, but unlike violent struggle, ijtihad is about struggling to understand our world by using our minds. This kind of struggle implies using our minds to reason, to ask questions that may challenge cultural practices, ancient tradition, and ruffle more than a few feathers along the way. Ijtihad isn't just for Muslims, writes one of her readers. Throw away the confines of political correctness and discuss, debate, challenge, and learn. A brown Muslim woman inspiring a white Christian man, isn't freedom great? Well, many do not think it's great and respond rather violently that it isn't, particularly against women. Manji has received many, many death threats and offensive attacks against her writing. I think her criticism of Islam and of the West as well, for that matter, is so much harder to hear in the Islamic world. When the threatening power of the U.S. military is on your borders or has bases in your country. Particularly hard to hear when you feel your cultural values are constantly under attack by the seduction of American entertainment industry propagating abhorrent values that may contradict your faith. What Manji effectively does is begin to tease apart Islam and culture. She claims the merciful and compassionate Allah revealed by Muhammad, peace be upon him, encourages ijtihad. Freedom of conscience can be supported in the Quran by verses like, unto you your religion, unto me my religion, 109:6. Whosoever will, let him believe, and whosoever will, let him unbelieve, 18:29. And let there be no compulsion in religion, 2:56. Where most of the trouble can be found is in the traditions and cultural practices that existed before Muhammad was born. Those cultural viruses, Manji calls Islamo-tribalism. The status of women in society and the family seems to be ground zero for a lot of the conflict in the clash of cultures. Take the example of the hijab. The Quran doesn't specifically mandate it. What the Quran does mandate is modesty in dress for both men and women. that has a wide latitude of interpretation, which does not require covering the head, but might be interpreted to include wearing loose-fitting clothing with long sleeves and pants. Most mature Unitarian Universalist women would easily qualify under this definition of modest dress, at least in the winter. Many of the restrictions imposed on women are not based on the Quran at all. There is no support in the Quran for honor killings of women whose behavior their family find offensive. Family reputation functions in the Middle East as a powerful force to squelch the voices of the young who might speak out against religious intolerance by their elders. What is at stake, and why the muftis, imams, and family patriarchs hold on to power so tightly, is their fear of a breakdown of their social order if Western ideas take root. And daughters adopting Western ways and marrying outside the faith represent, in their minds, the leading wave of that breakdown. I hear 18th century Englishmen advancing this kind of argument as they watched their cherished values and practices being discarded and disrespected by the settlers in their American colonies. The great scholar, writer, and social and literary critic, Dr. Samuel Johnson, took it upon himself to write a fiery satirical pamphlet in 1775 criticizing the reasons these backwoods hicks offered for separating from the crown. He called the restive colonials zealots of anarchy and sneered at these lords of themselves, these kings of me, these demagogues of independence. Dr. Johnson's primary critique was of their assertion that people have natural rights, a claim he labeled wild, indefinite, obscure. To him, liberty could mean almost anything. And this idea that people had to consent to be governed, what kind of poppycock was this? It was license to rebellion and chaos. And what about those slaveholding Virginians wanting liberty for themselves? What about their slaves? Wasn't it hypocritical to be claiming freedom for yourself while enslaving others? Dr. Johnson and his English contemporaries didn't believe freedom was a natural right. Rights didn't exist in nature. He used the example of a man and his dog alone in the wilderness. The man would command the dog to catch him some food, and the cur would refuse. Then they would congratulate each other on having freedom as they starved to death. Johnson believed that rights were created and guaranteed by government. Without being subject to a governing structure, we had no rights at all. Dr. Johnson's contemporary and friend Edmund Burke agreed with his reasoning, but reserved a little curiosity. Why did these crazy colonialists behave so strangely? His analysis remains insightful into the diverse foundations of the American character and the culture wars that continue today. Burke saw two important factors at work in the roots of the colonialists' extravagant claims for liberty. The first was the result of Southern slavery. What seemed hypocritical to Johnson was explanatory to Burke. Being the masters of slaves elevated them in their own eyes, he thought. Forcing someone into servitude can make one intolerant, if not fearful, of finding oneself in the same position. Many of the objections the colonialists used against England were framed in the language of slavery. The second argument came from examining those self-important, visible saints in Boston. Those Puritans felt they were God's chosen people, the elect who had no masters save the Almighty. They were completely unwilling to submit themselves to the authority of the Archbishop in Canterbury. Why would they bow before King George either? Who better to govern the new world, the new Jerusalem, the new saved world than the holy men they thought themselves to be? Thus Burke concluded, this American idea of liberty is grounded in privilege and arrogance. Take away their governing structures and they will descend into chaos and anarchy. When the British did just that, the colonialists seemed to do just fine without their British overlords, which caused Burke to sit up and take notice. Maybe these upstarts were on to something. The temple priests and the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem must have also been fearful of anarchy and chaos when that rogue Galilean was upsetting the tables of the money changers, keeping the profane Roman currency from entering the temple and the stools of the people selling pigeons for lawful sacrifices. Who did he think he was, coming in by himself to make a prophetic protest claiming the temple should be a house of prayer and calling it a den of robbers? To my mind, Jesus was to the Jews of his day what Manji is to Islam today. Jesus challenged convention and custom that he felt compromised the covenant of Abraham. But he did it differently than the other messiahs of his day, wanting to cleanse the temple and run the Romans out of town. Jesus asked his followers to practice their faith in a different way, guided internally rather than externally. That is why the reading from Mark today is so radical. Jesus claimed that what goes into your mouth doesn't defile you. Such a claim was completely at odds with kosher dietary law. Of course, if you are poor and starving, keeping three sets of dishes was and still is next to impossible. Even washing your hands before you eat is a challenge. If any water you might have, you'll need to quench your thirst. Then Jesus claimed, what comes out of your mouth is what matters. Just following the rules wasn't enough. You need to do the right thing for the right reason, with a pure heart. That is why he believed it was okay to heal on the Sabbath. That's why he didn't rebuke his disciples when they picked grain as they were walking past a field on the Sabbath. The law said you couldn't work on the Sabbath. Jesus argued that the circumstances and the intention of your heart mattered more than the rule. To be faithful meant to think of for yourself and make your own choices. In other words, Jesus was preaching and practicing individual freedom. He was a model of it when he walked into the temple all by himself to protest the corruption he saw in it. Quoting the prophets before him, to be sure, but ready to put his life on the line for his own free judgment. Fast forward 2,000 years, and you can see the perfection of individual freedom within Unitarian Universalism. We are not bound to a creed or to a book. Each individual is given the freedom to work out their beliefs, guided by their own conscience. We are ardent in our confidence in the powers of the human mind to seek truth and deeper meaning. The Protestant rallying cry was, "Solo Scriptorum," only Scripture. UU's might respond, "Solo Logos," only the reasoning mind. Emerson remains a bright light of this kind of thinking. He believed our contact with the divine was through our intuition, our inner sense of truth. Direct personal experience processed through the fire of thought could guide us to living authentic lives. If that meant going against the crowd, so be it. Living from the inside out rather than the outside in was Emerson's central ethic. While there is great value to Emerson's radically free approach to truth, it has some limitations as well. Those limitations have become greater and greater problems for our congregations in the last half of the 20th century. When everyone in a congregation goes their own way, sometimes an intolerance of each other can develop. Infatuation with the truth you believe you have found can diminish your appreciation of the truth another has found that seems to contradict yours. This lack of cohesion can undermine our congregation's ability to act and advocate effectively for our values in the public square. Conservative churches, willing to submit to a central authority, do not have this problem. One reason they have been so effective at gradually rolling back women's reproductive rights over the last 40 years since Roe v. Wade. The way we preserve our freedom and find ways to act together is by making commitments to each other. That is what we are trying to do right now as we craft a new mission statement. We're looking for language that encourages us to be more active in the world while at the same time protecting our individual seeking for truth and deeper meaning. Whatever we may find individually, whatever we believe, we acknowledge that our relationships with and to each other must be constrained by a sense of fairness we call justice. We also want to acknowledge that we are part of a greater biological whole that demands our compassionate relationship rather than domination. To enter into committed relationship as a congregation, we need to accept some voluntary self-limitation. In congregational life, I accepted this long ago, that the structure of the institution, its values and its actions or its inactions will never completely satisfy me. And I accept that I do not control the congregation. We work together here in partnership where all voices are heard and the majority decides. We strive for unanimity as much as possible, but we yield to the majority. This is why it is so important that everyone participate in one way or another in distilling who we are into our common purpose. our mission statement. I realize that for many of us, this effort isn't the most exciting thing that we do, but that doesn't diminish its importance. Your leaders need to understand clearly who we are and what we value. The better we define ourselves, the better we can empower our leaders to act in an inspired way. It is also crucial to those who are visiting our congregation to show them, without equivocation, our core values that inform what we say and what we do. And I, as minister, need to align my message here every Sunday morning to those values. So take advantage of the opportunity to respond to our mission task force, current attempt to rewrite our mission in words after the service today. You can also email us. You'll find that address, fusamission@albanyu.org, right here. You can send in your comments that way. It's really important that we balance both the group and the individual. And when we do it well and we find agreement, our success will take some stress out of our congregational life and empower our work. After all, neither I nor any of your leaders want to be figuratively crucified because we got those values wrong. So be it.